Chapter 3, opening quote by Reinhold Niebuhr. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace. Chapter 3, title, Reckoning, the second step in the healing process. It's surprising how the simple act of abiding often helps us come to peace with hardships that we face. Many people need nothing more than giving themselves permission to have a safe emotional environment in which to express themselves. That, in and of itself, creates peace and opens vistas for hope and new perspectives. On the other hand, abiding is not always enough. Ventilating feelings might feel good, yet accomplish little, especially if the aspect of self-generating the feeling is ignored. Facing the difficulty and strategizing ways to effectively reckon with it are also important so that we can change our relationship with the problem by integrating the part of self dealing with the situation. This is a different process than simply trying to, quote unquote, move on or get over it. Get beyond it. Confronting difficulties helps us let go of perspectives that may be contributing to a problem and opens us to new possibilities so we can be changed for the better. Confronting problems requires a deeper process that I call reckoning. Reckoning is changing our relationship to problematic situations, relationships, or aspects of self by cultivating the honesty, courage, and humility to face the source of distress. Cultivating these qualities often occurs by discovering a needed lesson. However, the purpose of the lesson is not to teach, but rather to help us be. The lesson is only the vehicle to achieve qualities of beingness, which again, the qualities are honesty, courage, and humility. Abiding is a journey of the heart. We open our heart to our feelings and to the aspect of ourselves generating the emotion. Reckoning, on the other hand, is a journey of the head. Reckoning helps us let go of our need to forget, minimize, rationalize, justify, or deny. We become more able and willing to let go of coping mechanisms and open up to the truth of who we are and who we are not. Reckoning requires that we look at more than behaviors. We have to examine the cause of behaviors. For example, alcoholics have to quit drinking in order to restore their lives. After they remain sober, they have to address what caused them to drink in the first place. If they are unable to reckon with the source of their distress, they become what's known as, quote unquote, dry drunks. They may not be getting into the trouble that intoxication previously caused, but they still numb their feelings and fail to develop honesty, courage, and humility to live their lives effectively. It may be tempting to jump right to reckoning without first abiding with the accompanying feelings. We want to fix problems and find solutions. Reckoning without abiding, however, might mean incomplete healing because the emotional dimension is not engaged. Although willpower might accomplish the goal, it's not heartfelt, nor is it long-lasting. Jumping too quickly to reckoning means we minimize our suffering. We gloss over the strength and courage it takes to face and carry our burdens. Reckoning without first abiding might mean that the aspect of self generating the unpleasant emotion is left stranded and silenced. On the other hand, abiding without reckoning might mean that I stay stuck in a victim mode. A victim perspective keeps us bitter and powerless, if the feelings relate to guilt, anger, fear, or sadness, or irresponsible and cowardly, if the feelings relate solely to maintaining happiness and comfort. It's easy to confuse reckoning with coping, yet they are distinctly different processes. Coping is like cutting the tops off our weeds, whereas reckoning pulls our weeds out by the roots. Coping is a passive process. whereas reckoning is an active process. Coping often includes denial, an unconscious process that keeps us from seeing reality. Some people even say that denial is an acronym for don't even know, spelled with an N, not a K, I am lying. Don't even know I am lying. Denial. Reckoning inserts consciousness into a problem, whereas coping diminishes consciousness. Diminishing consciousness is often done by pretending that everything is quote-unquote fine. Fine is an acronym for freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and empty. Coping closes down to the problem, whereas reckoning opens up to it. A patient told me one day, "We need to have a come-to-Jesus meeting." He explained that what he meant was that his family needed to stop sugarcoating the prognosis and instead get honest so they could face his death together. In other words, he needed them to stop coping and start reckoning. In describing coping in this light, I don't mean to imply that coping is bad. We can't be on the reckoning path all the time. All of us need times to chill out, numb out, and go into neutral. Too often, however, we misuse coping as an avoidance mechanism that shields us from uncomfortable feelings and realities. Reckoning means being willing to endure the discomfort that accompanies making internal change. Rather than coping with the situation by fighting or flighting the discomfort, reckoning means struggling with the discomfort as part of the coming to grips process. Although I've mentioned the discomfort that accompanies change, it bears repeating. The transition period that occurs after we let something go and before we have incorporated something new is fraught with tension, fraught with urges to return to old habits. Morton describes this discomfort as navigating a quote-unquote awful abyss that occurs after the shattering and before the new reality appears. End of quote. Tolerating the tension during the abyss is a key element in successful reckoning. The struggle is necessary, however, because it allows larger lessons to surface. Coping with a problem rather than reckoning with it means that my suffering is in vain because I didn't figure out the lesson that I need. Wasting suffering means that I miss an opportunity to grow in honesty, courage, and humility. It's not easy to change from coping to reckoning. Coping feels comfortable, like an old pair of favorite shoes we're used to wearing. It's no wonder that it takes effort and resolve to quote-unquote break in new reckoning processes. Most stories you read in my books depict people who shifted from coping to reckoning. Some stopped coping with their problems by flighting into alcohol before they started reckoning with their feelings that made them want to drink in the first place. Others coped with their impending death by pretending that their illness was not terminal. But at some point, they started reckoning with their mortality by courageously preparing for death. Some people in my stories stopped coping with their trauma by isolating themselves, and they began to reckon with their trauma by reaching out for help or helping other people. As a result, they often become what I call, quote-unquote, wounded healers, repairing harm they caused, preventing similar harm from recurring, and sharing their wisdom with others who have been similarly afflicted. I frequently use the words honesty, courage, and humility throughout this book. I do so consciously because they capture the qualities I believe we each need to cultivate if we are going to be heroes in our own lives. It requires honesty to let go of illusions, denials, and pretenses so that we can open up to our authentic self, including the aspects of ourselves we'd prefer to hide. It takes courage to let go of our fears and instead show up for things in our life we'd prefer to fight, flight, or freeze. Paradoxically, humility empowers us. We gain real power when we let go of pride and willpower and open up to acknowledge our needs and ask for help. A humble heart is a teachable heart. Joe is a patient who demonstrates a teachable heart. He shifted from coping to reckoning. Rather than continuing to cope with his problems by numbing their impact with alcohol, he decided to use his problems as a passport into his deeper self, where he discovered honesty, courage, and humility. Joe was 58 years old. He had both bladder and colon cancers. He didn't know what to do or where to turn. Often, he came to the VA hospital. Each time he came, I was consulted. No matter the ward to which he was admitted, the story was the same. His pain was out of control, and so was he. Angry at what was happening to him, Joe lashed out at staff members. Staff felt helpless, and Joe would go back home without effective treatment for his distress. It was Joe's utter loneliness that struck me. He spoke of his physical pain, but pain of non-physical dimensions echoed in his voice. He was filled with bitterness. Each time I met with him, a different aspect of his suffering self emerged. His mother had abused him as a child, and eventually she had abandoned him. Her efforts to reach out to him in his adult life only angered him further. When she phoned him, Joe wouldn't talk to her. Although his children lived close by, he seldom saw them. He still loved his ex-wife, but his drinking had driven her away. His sister visited occasionally, but he thought she was bossy and discouraged her visits. As he talked about his life, he cried. I listened, validating his suffering. I let myself feel his pain, abiding his anguish, fear, anger, and despair. Joe became weaker and was no longer able to stay in his mobile home alone. He was behind in his bills. His pain remained out of control. I knew if he was ever to move from coping with his suffering to reckoning with it, that he would need love and patience beyond what I, alone, could provide. Admitting him to our unit, I asked for help from our hospice and palliative care staff. Joe remained aloof and suspicious after admission, continuing to lash out. Nothing we did satisfied him. He tested our patience with his demands. He remained a loner. Much of the day and night, he rode the unit's electric scooter outside to smoke. I asked Joe about his faith. Yes, he believed in God. No, he didn't feel God's love. Yes, he was angry at God. No, he couldn't feel God's presence in his life. Yes, he wanted to explore non-religious spiritual dimensions of himself. Yes, he wanted prayer. I hesitated about praying for him right then, but I offered it anyway, and he accepted. I took a deep breath to let myself abide his sufferings before I started. Then I prayed. Dear God, this man comes before you feeling broken and used. He has suffered the brokenness of the world and feels lost and forsaken. He needs your love and your light to show him how to walk in darkness. Help him feel your mercy and your grace so he can feel whole again. Help him feel worthy. Help him know he is valued and important. Give him the courage to open up to your love and the love of others he can trust. Help him let go of the wall that he's built to keep others away. Help him start depending on you. Help all of us caring for Joe to be trustworthy. Help us listen carefully to his needs. Help us respond with patience and kindness, even when we don't want to do so. When we fail him, help us acknowledge that failure so we can change. I pray all these things this day. Amen. Joe cried throughout that prayer. Little by little, with staff who were willing to abide his pain and suffering, Joe began reckoning with his unfinished business. First, he focused on his relationship with his ex-wife. He wrote to her acknowledging how he had let her down. She began visiting on weekends. They talked about getting married again. Soon his sister and his daughter began visiting. He was able to ask for forgiveness for the pain that his anger and bitterness had caused them. He confronted his mother about the abuse he had suffered. Although she wouldn't apologize as he had hoped, he still forgave her. At first he forgave her because he thought it was the right thing to do for her sake. Later he came to realize he had to forgive her for his own sake. Joe wrote a letter to the staff. This is what the letter said. I have had a bout with cancer for a long time. I wasn't going any place with the curing or the pain. I was very depressed and at the end of my rope until I met you all in hospice. Before this, I was always promised this and that, but here I was treated with compassion and love I never had before. You knew when I was in pain and I was taken care of right away. I was screaming and you would come and touch me, and before long my pain was relieved. I wish I was a rich man so I could help hospice out with their needs. But all I can do is look toward hospice and have a heart, because you have a heart, and I love you all dearly. This is hard for me to say because of my past. Thank you for listening. His unfinished business completed, Joe said that he was ready to die. A few days later, he asked one of the nurses, Sheila, to read the 23rd Psalm. She read the passage, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me." It was then that Sheila noticed that Joe was staring toward the ceiling. She asked Joe what he was seeing. He said, "God." Sheila said, "What does God look like?" Joe closed his eyes and said, "Beautiful, swirling colors like a rainbow." Sheila continued her reading. When she was done, she looked up and she saw that Joe had died. The meaning of Joe's life did not stop with his death. A patient who had often smoked with Joe came to the unit. He spoke about the transformation he had witnessed. He said to us, "Did you all know that Joe initiated prayer circles with other patients outside in the smoking area?" We were surprised and not surprised. We also received a request from Joe's daughter. She said, quote, "Dad changed so much in the last few months. He wasn't the same man that people in our hometown knew. Could you contribute to his eulogy to help people understand Dad's transformation?" So Pat, one of the nurses, wrote an account of Joe's final journey to redeem his suffering. It was through Pat's account that people became privileged witnesses to a man's journey into holiness. 2 days after the funeral, we received another letter, this time from Joe's daughter. This is what it said. To everyone at hospice, you were firm when you had to be firm, and you were soft but not too mushy when Dad would allow you to be soft. I'm so thankful that he had you. I'm thankful you gave him the unconditional love he needed and the tools, when he was ready, to let go of his anger and his hurt, which allowed him to forgive and to ask for forgiveness. He grew so much in your care. I'm also thankful you were there for him right up to his last breath. It was such a comfort to know that he saw God as beautiful, swirling colors. The letter you sent for Dad's eulogy was wonderful. Otherwise, no one would have known how Dad changed. That letter was an incredible testimony that amazed and comforted everyone. The work that Joe did to abide his feelings and reckon with his suffering birthed the hero hidden within him. He was able to redeem the destiny he was born to fulfill. However, his work could not begin until he felt safe enough to do it. Surrounding him with staff who were willing to abide his distress provided the safety that he needed. Once he realized that he no longer needed to cope by running from himself and others, he let himself become vulnerable, owning his feelings so that segregated pieces of self generating the emotion could be coaxed out of hiding. As a result, newfound hope inspired him to change his relationship to his bitterness. He decided to let the bitterness go and open up to developing a teachable heart. He asked and received help from others who were willing to abide with him. This courage forged his journey into heroism. He became a hero not only for himself, but for all of us who were privileged to witness his transformation. We even named two hallways on our hospice unit in honor of his bravery. Forgiveness Street and Peace Boulevard remind us that we, too, are called to do the work that Joe did in our own lives. We, too, are called to become heroes for ourselves. We, too, have the opportunity to redeem the destiny we were born to fulfill. In fact, Viktor Frankl writes that we have a responsibility to discover and fulfill our unique destiny. When we fail to discover our unique destiny, our passion dries up and our efforts toward personal fulfillment are thwarted because we've lost the power of the destiny seed implanted in our very being. However, when we sensitize ourselves to the calling to be whole, we recognize hardships as guideposts for coming home unto ourselves. Our suffering encourages us to let go of a non-productive path so that we can merge onto a deeper interior path that leads to a bona fide destiny. Chapter subheading, The Reckoning Qualities. Joe used the despair of his illness to encounter his interior hero. It wasn't willpower, control, or pride that transported him there. It was honesty, courage, and humility. He didn't quote-unquote rise above or transcend his illness. He moved into its depths. He was willing to see who he was and who he was not. He was willing to acknowledge his limitations and ask for help. He didn't quote-unquote put his past behind him. Rather, he integrated his past so it could be used for healing. Joe was willing to change. Once he changed, a new world opened up to him because he now had access to the energy of his deeper self. I commented on the quality of humility that I saw Joe develop as he used his emotional pain as a passport into his interior hero. He expressed regret that he hadn't learned the lesson sooner. He said, "It was pride. Until now, I've been arrogant. I was unteachable because I wasn't willing to change, so my suffering increased. But when I'm humble, I become teachable, and my suffering eases." Change is like that. It always requires that we let go of something, usually something that is safe and familiar, and open up to something different, which doesn't yet feel safe and familiar. This is why change often requires courage. It took courage for Joe to let go of the arrogant self who protected his inadequate self. Until Joe let his arrogant self go, he couldn't open up to his humble self. Once his humble self was set free, Joe grew. Change also requires honesty. All of us have an arrogant self, although most of us are too arrogant to acknowledge that. Joe was not only able to acknowledge his arrogance, he was able to use it as a passport into his humble self so that he could experience healing. Healing is not the same as management of symptoms. Although managing symptoms minimizes distress, it does not require inward lessons and changes. Healing is not the same as cure, either. Healing doesn't require the distress to be removed. This distinction is important because there are many problems that cannot be erased. Healing means we are able to open ourselves to the distress so we can change our relationship with the problem. This is an important concept because when a problem recurs, it can be tempting to think that no healing occurred. For example, Joe still had times when he felt insecure. His impoverished childhood could not be erased, and he was not magically, quote-unquote, cured of the distress of feeling inadequate. Because he still experienced inadequacy, however, does not mean that he did not experience healing. By letting himself encounter his inadequacy and reach out for help with it, he was able to develop an open relationship with his inadequate self. His inadequate self was then no longer alone. He was also able to infuse his inadequate self with new messages of self-worth, thereby gradually changing his experience. Honesty allows us to perceive the illusions that we generate so we can experience the world the way it is rather than the way we want it to be. Illusions effectively shield us from our deeper selves. For example, because Joe lived in the illusion that he was unlovable because of his mother's abuse, he treated himself as if he were worthless. His drinking numbed his feelings of rejection. Ironically, even though he was angry at his mother for treating him so disrespectfully, Joe treated himself with the same disrespect and abuse. However, when he was willing to reckon with the illusions he had maintained, Joe then accessed his interior hero. That hero supplied him with the truth that he was worthy of respect. When we open up to our illusions, we can use them to encounter truth. Reckoning is the means by which we find truth. Reckoning requires that I become more honest, courageous, and humble. Paradoxically, I have to open up to the ways that I am dishonest, cowardly, and proud in order to achieve this. Otherwise, I'll create illusions that keep me from owning these very human qualities that are part of my truth. Reckoning requires mindfulness about the many ways we have of fooling ourselves into thinking that we've participated in the reckoning process when we haven't. Excuses such as, "I rose above it," or "I'm not going to let that get to me," can effectively delude us into excusing ourselves from doing inner work. Reckoning requires honestly discerning the distinction between a reason and an excuse. Joe kept excusing his self-abusive usage of alcohol and his angry abuse of others by saying, "No one cares about me anyway." But when he got honest with himself, his excuse changed into an honest reason. He could say, "I drink because it's easier than figuring out the ways that I'm worthwhile and important. Drinking is easier than learning how to develop an internal mother who knows how to nurture me." It requires courage to discern reasons from excuses, but healing doesn't happen until we dig deeper to discover the reasons. Not only that, but rising above a hardship means that I become less me, because I will use willpower and control to keep the vitality of me stifled. However, when I open up to the hardship or my limitation, I become more myself, and the resources of that self become available. It's easy to deceive ourselves into thinking that we've learned a valuable lesson by reckoning with the problem when we have actually coped by sweeping the problem under the carpet of fear. One patient, Evelyn, swept a bitter divorce under the carpet by adopting a quote-unquote, "all men are jerks" stance. As a result, she never remarried. Instead, she had numerous transient relationships with untrustworthy men who reinforced her "all men are jerks" lesson, which she thought she had learned. Evelyn only knew how to cope with her rejection and disappointment rather than abide and reckon with her feelings of hurt, inadequacy, and rejection. She didn't yet know how to use her anger to transport her into herself so that she could meet her rejected self, an interior aspect who needed her love and attention rather than her fear and neglect. Therefore, she let fear control her subsequent decisions relating to male relationships. Evelyn started developing courage. She started working through issues relating to her birth mother who had placed her for adoption. By the time Evelyn became an adult and searched for her mother had died. Nevertheless, Evelyn learned how to abide and reckon with her feelings of loss and abandonment. She was able to reckon with lingering resentments and achieve a level of forgiveness. Her previous lesson of, "I'm not worthwhile or lovable because I was given away," yielded to a more mature lesson of, "I was innocent. My mother giving me away had nothing to do with who I am. I am worth knowing and loving. Some people may reject me, but that won't keep me from seeking trustworthy people who can accept me." Needless to say, this new insight affected her subsequent relationships with men. She was able to see both their good and not so good qualities, which empowered her. She was then able to let go of her supposed lesson that all men were jerks, and instead seek reliable men who treated her respectfully. Although initially Evelyn thought she could change the men that she dated, she subsequently learned how to let that illusion go so she could open up to the truth of the need to change herself. Evelyn's new perspective meant that her suffering was not wasted, but rather used to help her personal growth. Unfortunately, it's easier to blame others for causing us to feel ugly feelings than it is to use those feelings to take care of the aspect of self experiencing them. Paradoxically, we become empowered when we abide those feelings and seek opportunities to learn from them by reckoning with the lessons they are trying to provide. Discerning coping from reckoning is necessary to learn these lessons. Discernment isn't always easy, however, because outcomes don't make the distinction. For example, Evelyn divorced her husband because she coped with difficulties by running away rather than reckoning with internal changes that were needed to develop a successful relationship. Many people, however, might do just the opposite. They cope with a bad relationship by staying in it rather than reckon with the discomfort of making needed internal changes so they can let go of the relationship. Sorting out coping from reckoning is important, and the distinction depends on whether someone is opening up or closing down to an interior aspect of self. Coping keeps unwanted aspects walled off. Reckoning brings them home. Reckoning leads to healing. Although reckoning requires that we journey into the wilderness of our soul, a cautious pace should be maintained. The trick is to be able to maintain enough of ourselves in the wilderness so that we don't flee to the security of marked paths. Proceeding too quickly or haphazardly, however, allows the briars and brambles of unmarked paths to rip apart our emotional skin. Chapter subheading: Acknowledge and Validate Limitations and Suffering. When I can accept my limitations, I no longer have to fear what will come or feel guilty for what I cannot do. Instead, I grow into myself with confidence of who I am and who I am not. Validating our limitations is a willingness to acknowledge and bear witness to our difficult experiences. It means resisting the urge to tell ourselves, it'll get better, count your blessings, don't be so negative, or any of the other things that indirectly communicate, I don't want to hear about your problems. Don't let yourself feel human. Put up that stoic wall and hide behind it. Validating suffering means that we acknowledge when we have a problem, which is not always easy for people who are proud. At a young age, Viktor Frankl learned a wisdom about suffering that takes a lifetime for most of us to appreciate. While in a German concentration camp, Frankl said that there was, quote, no need to be ashamed of tears, for tears bear witness that a man has the greatest of courage, the courage to suffer, end of quote. Once we're able to validate our own suffering, we are more able to validate others. A 41-year-old newly admitted hospice patient once told me about a conversation he had with a nurse who had transported him from another unit. The patient said, I told that nurse that it was hard to come here to hospice, and her answer was, it's not so bad here. Look at the pretty pictures they have on the walls. I'm about to die, and she's telling me about pretty pictures. People often bear heavy sufferings, especially at the end of life. Platitudes about smiling or keeping their chins up are just another way of telling them to look at the pretty pictures on the walls. Saying these kinds of things can also erode their self-confidence. One patient told me, I'm scared and miserable, but everyone keeps telling me that things are going to get better. I must be weak. I wouldn't be feeling so miserable. We sell people short when we don't respect their capacity to suffer. We miss the opportunity to affirm their courage in carrying their load. Simple statements that affirm their suffering can have the opposite effect. Statements such as, you've had a hard go of it, or it takes a lot of courage to go through all of this. Those statements tell people that someone understands how hard their situation is. These kinds of statements also indirectly validate their resiliency and the sheer courage that it has taken to carry their load. People have told me how grateful they are when I validate their suffering and how it lessens their sense of isolation. Validating suffering helps people develop genuine appreciation and respect for what they've been through and the enormity of what they have accomplished just to get through it. Validating personal suffering was important in prisoner of war camps. Some POWs have told me that optimistic prisoners had the most difficult time during confinement. Frankel writes about similar experiences in the concentration camp that he was in. He says, quote, "It was the incorrigible optimists who were the most irritating companions," end of quote. "They were also the most vulnerable," he said, "living in the naive hope that they would be home in a few weeks. When weeks passed and nothing had changed, they despaired." Frankel says that disappointment overcame them, and that had a deleterious effect on their powers of resistance, and many died. He says that those who did best were not cynical, they were just fiercely realistic. He writes, quote, "We refused to minimize or alleviate the camp's tortures by ignoring them or harboring false illusions and entertaining artificial optimism. Suffering had become a task on which we did not want to turn our backs. We had realized its hidden opportunities for achievement." End of quote. Opportunities for achievement can even be measured. The American Psychological Association uses a post-traumatic growth inventory to assess negative and positive changes sustained after life-altering events like Frankel experienced in the concentration camp. However, the scale is useful in assessing a person's relationship to any event, even if it's not traumatic. 5 categories of change that occur after significant events are identified as relating to others, new possibilities, personal strength, spiritual change, and appreciation of life. The inventory helps determine the relationship we keep to the hardships that we've borne. It can also provide clues to changes we might want to make so we can develop a more enlightened perspective. Enlightened perspectives are not gained by blotting out experiences or numbing emotional responses with positive thinking. An experience becomes, quote-unquote, positive when we are not afraid to embrace it and struggle with the internal changes that the experience requires. The deleterious effects of, quote-unquote, artificial optimism that Frankel describes with prisoners cause just as much damage when used to solve everyday problems. Rather, positive thinking should focus on giving ourselves encouragement to have confidence that we can navigate the difficulties of life. Then, we don't have to take quick-fix paths that temporarily relieve discomfort. It's not about making my pain go away, but about making me competent enough to assess the hero within me to learn from my distress. I may not be responsible for the pain, but I am responsible for reckoning with it. I used to fear that validating suffering would encourage patients to sit on the pity pot. Then I realized that self-pity was not a bad thing as long as it wasn't used to avoid facing problems. I realized the goal was to be able to get on and off the pity pot as needed. People who are stoic, in fact, often needed help acknowledging their own suffering. I also feared that validating suffering with whiny people would foster more whining. I was surprised to discover that many people complain in an attempt to get someone to validate their suffering. Once heard, they often don't need to whine as much. I've also learned that just because people can talk about their trauma doesn't mean they are reckoning with it. People sometimes cope by shielding themselves with an emotional detachment from the trauma. One woman told me she was in the grocery store when she overheard heard a soldier talking on his cell phone. She said, "He had just gotten back from Iraq, and he was talking about gruesome things as if he were describing beans on the store shelf." When I heard this, I wasn't surprised. Staying detached, almost as if it happened to a different person, provides emotional survival and and prevents feeling overwhelmed with horror. However, talking detachedly about trauma does not mean that the trauma is integrated into the person's experience. In fact, it may mean just the opposite. Chapter subheading, Reaching Out for Help. Healing requires that we open up to the ways we are victims and the ways we are heroes. To open up to all aspects of our humanity, we have to let go of who we are so we can open up to who we are capable of becoming. However, letting go of our current self causes ambiguity and uncertainty. Developing tolerance for uncertainty during times of transition is a struggle. It's why transitional times, such as teenage years, midlife, or the time before death, can be so difficult. We want progress to be continuous. Instead, it's marked with indolent periods while new thoughts and behaviors are incubating. Conditioned for instant gratification, we are vulnerable to return to old habits. As one woman told me, "I'm determined to change today, at least until it becomes unpleasant. When it becomes unpleasant, I'm going to go back to eating cookies." I often counsel people to develop a strategy for times of transition because that is when we are most vulnerable for going back to eat the cookies. To encourage patients not to take an easy way out, I sometimes say to them, "This quest you are on is hard, but it's important." I also encourage them to take deep breaths. I found that deep breathing increases our tolerance for struggle. Breathing gives space to our demons so they loosen their chokehold that cuts off our air and our power. Breathing allows us the opportunity to relax and open up to possibilities beyond our fear. The trick is remembering to do it when we feel overwhelmed with uncertainty. The other trick is to ask for help when we feel vulnerable to betraying ourselves. Pride, independence, and need to control make asking for help difficult. The difficulty usually involves feelings of inadequacy, which we tend to bear silently. Much of my work with people includes helping them understand the importance of identifying needs and asking for help from trustworthy people. This strategy might mean something as simple as reaching out to family members and talking about the difficulties they are having. For many, participating in a healing community is therapeutic. I will describe this process in detail in Chapter 8. For others, it might mean reaching out to professional staff. It might mean joining a church or social community. Sometimes it requires more formal venues for help, such as joining a 12-step recovery program or obtaining a good counselor. Pride, need for control, and stubborn independence interfere with reaching out. When we reach out for help with our limitations and suffering, we develop the honesty, courage, and humility to change. When our perspective changes, our world changes. It reminds me of a story that Rachel Naomi Remen writes about in her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. Three 14th century stonecutters are building a cathedral. Though each performed the same tedious and methodical task, each offered a different perspective on his work. One stonecutter bitterly complained that his job was to cut stones into blocks and he was going to be stuck doing it for the rest of his life. Another worker warmly reported that he was earning a living for his beloved family. Stone cutting allowed him to create a home that they could fill with love. Remen writes, quote, "But it is the third man whose response gives us pause. In a joyous voice, he tells us of the privilege of participating in the building of this great cathedral so strong that it will stand as a holy lighthouse for 1,000 years. End of quote. I find it ironic that I have spent so many years searching outside myself for just the right bricks so I could build a holy lighthouse, one that everyone would admire, when all along I was holding the bricks in my own hands and my job was to develop the honesty, courage, and humility to discover the unique lighthouse I was destined to create.